Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are going to share their wisdom and their use of humour. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business success in your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Marcus Brigstock, and very soon I'll be appearing with Paul Barros on the Humorology Podcast. You should listen to it.
Have you had any very memorable heckles?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but mine now exist in a certain context. So I've been a member of CND since I was about 15. I've never really grown out of it. I sort of had a look and thought, I'm not sure that weapons that can kill that many people at once can ever be used with any precision or justification. So I thought I'll be a member of CND. And CND asked me to go on the pyramid stage at Glastonbury to talk about the campaign for nuclear disarmament. And it was around about the time Barack Obama was taking office, and he was the first president to talk about reducing America's nuclear stockpile. And I said, yeah, fine. Anyway, unbeknownst to me, they put an act on just before I went on stage, and it was a hip-hop outfit called NERD, Pharrell Williams Group. And NERD overran, and you can't overrun at Glastonbury because they've, you know, you've got the Rolling Stones waiting to come on. So they cut their mics and pulled them off stage, and the audience went mental. 60,000 people booing and chanting, N-E-R-D, N-E-R-D, like this. And the stage manager went, there you go, mate, your mic's live. And I walked to the front of the stage in front of all these people and went, hello, I'm Marcus Brigstock. You may have seen me or heard me on Radio 4. And I want to talk about the campaign for nuclear disarmament, at which point, in one voice, 60,000 people screamed, fuck off! They were literally, one guy, I remember how he looked. He was sort of wiry thin, looked like Iggy Pop. He was lifted by his friends in order that I could see how much he hated me. And so I talked for about 5 or 10 minutes about CND and shuffled off. It wasn't a gig, you know, I wasn't really trying to be funny on that occasion. But since then, all heckles have existed in the context of, mate, I've been booed off by 60,000 people. I mean, this is your
tell us a joke, your mum.
It doesn't, you know, doesn't amount to much.
Hi, I'm Dave Johns, and I'm a guest on Paul Barros's Humorology Podcast.
What would the world be like without humour?
I think it would be an absolutely diabolical, horrible, miserable place. I think if human beings didn't have humour, I don't think we'd be able to survive. I think humour is part and parcel of surviving. And I think, you always hear, oh, that person doesn't have a sense of humour, you know? To not have humour, it's a really bad affliction. To not see the funny side of life. To not, see, that's how my brain is wired up. I see it all the time, you know. It's like when I was over in when Daniel Blake won the BAFTA. We went to the party afterwards, and we were at the party, and I was just getting a thing at the door at the bar, And I saw Meryl Streep coming towards the bar. And I thought, that's Meryl Streep. So I just went, Meryl, it's all free! And she pissed herself laughing. She went, is it? I went, yeah! You know? And that was just something off the top of my head. But I was thinking, shit, that's Meryl Streep. You know what I mean?
Hi, everyone. This is Spike Edney.
So do you think that, I mean, having been in bands myself, do you think that if it's not there, you can't stay for that long? For instance, you've been with Queen, I think, since, is it 1985 or something
84.
Like that?
August 1984. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, there must be something about adapting and getting rapport and having a sense of humour that makes them want to be around you for that many years.
Well, let's hope so. There are some bands who kind of thrive on tension and discord. And some of those bands actually do last as long as they take long holidays from each other. And I think that that is the key to any successful big band, is that absence makes the heart grow fonder as well. So then when you're together, you can have energy and fun has got to be a big part of it. Otherwise, life is miserable. I've been in situations on tour where a band is getting near the end of its life and everybody's just miserable in everybody else's company, and the smallest thing can be irksome. But that's the same in any group of people where somebody's slightly annoying habit becomes a major problem for another member of the band. So holidays are good, and having funny people around and in the band to ease the tension is definitely good.
Hi, I'm Scott Quinnell.
Do you find yourself funny?
My children and my wife say yes, because I say something and I laugh. Or even worse, I will laugh and then say something. So I got to be honest with you, if I did a gig and there was 30 of me in the audience, I'd be happy. I think I'd be all right.
Well, the funny thing is, I think that's the perfect answer, because as a psychologist, what I would say is that part of a comedian's job is to actually, or anybody who wants to be funny, wants to be liked, wants to have people laugh with them, is that they have to go into that state first. And that state transfers over to other people, because, you know, I've always said that you're infectious, haven't I?
Well, I've given you tablets for it. the thing is, when you talk about that, right, I think I'm more likely to laugh at myself. Do you know a lot of people sort of they're perfectionists and they want to do everything right? But I'm kind of the opposite, because I don't mind making mistakes, because a lot of the time it's quite funny. So I'm in a mindset of, because I struggled, because I was dyslexic and struggled to read and write and everything, I suppose that's my coping strategy. So where, you know, you either fought or you became funny. Now, I'm not that funny and I'm a bloody good fighter. So, you choose.
I think I'd rather laugh with you than fight you, to be honest with you.
I think it's important to be able to laugh at yourself. If you can't laugh at yourself, then you can't take the mickey out of other people. If you're in a room of people and you take something personally that they say, then it's all wrong. You know, you've got to be able to laugh at yourself before you expect other people to laugh at you.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince, and I joined Paul Barros on the Humorology podcast. I have an obsession with meetings people. There are people who just, you know what, if you want to, all that time, remove one meeting a day, because you don't need the five meetings you got. Remove that one meeting. You know what, just watch an episode of Man Down. Watch some Laurel and Hardy together. Watch something in a room together where you all find what you laugh at. And just, and that sense of bringing people together through laughter, not through the division of where are they, and that I think would be an amazing thing. I mean, there's two, you know, I have a rule, which is I don't do three meetings if nothing's happened after the first two meetings. So when we're working on projects, if someone says, can we have another meeting? I go, well, nothing's happened after the first two. When something's happened from the first two, then we need another meeting, but we don't need another meeting. So that's what I would say, is remove at least one meeting, and then every week or even every day, different person in the office brings in the thing that they find funniest, that they delight in, or you watch it on Netflix or whatever, and you just laugh in a room.
That's right. And it's the ultimate bonding thing, isn't it? It brings people together. So actually, and especially that, I think most companies on some level have to be creative.
Yeah.
So surely you have, in order to be creative, you have to allow the brain to go to different places rather than be siloed.
Well, as we know, you know, the best ideas never come up when you're staring at the screen trying to write the joke. They come up when you walk out, when you go for, you know, you go for a coffee, whatever. And I think that point of saying there, because I think we've become so hooked on believing we're being productive. And that's one of the reasons that we have this meetings obsession, is because a meeting means you've done something today, but you haven't done anything. You've had a meeting. That's not the same. I mean, I'm obsessed by that. That's why I run one of the things that I do with my mate Trent. We make about four programs a week, and we make documentaries and all that. And we just make them. We don't make them particularly for profit or anything like that. We just make them because we're addicted to making things. We want to create things. And I think that is a really important part of it as well. That, in fact, there is something more creative about having all sat in a room and laughed at something, you know, whether it's Rude and Strange or Laurel and Hardy, whatever it is. There's something far more creative that means that when you leave that room, like, you know, when during homeschooling with my son, you know, at lunchtime we might watch something like an episode of Friday Night Dinner, and we love it and we laugh, and then he goes back to work and I go back to work, but something has happened which has shaken the day, which is just, you know, it's moved, it feels like we've got more neural connections, positive neural connections available to us now because we've just watched something wonderful and absurd.
My name's Rene Carriol. In my younger days, when you're trying to climb up that greasy pole, I was a bit too intense, a bit too serious, never relaxing. Every day you're on show, every day you're on stage, and it wears you out. It just wears you out. And the prize you're aiming for is doesn't feel that glittering when you get there. When you've worked 15, 16-hour days, you haven't smiled, you're a bit too intense. So I realized that you got to break that up. Do a job that you love, you never work a day in your life. Smile and enjoy. The mastery of emotional intelligence. The ability to be the butt of jokes for others, especially those who work for you, lightens the atmosphere, enables them to get to know you, trust you. And you know what happens when people trust you? They go the extra mile.
I'm David McCourt. Is the bottom line the only thing that's important, or is contributing to the community in everybody's well-being, you know, just as important? Is it okay to make a little bit less money for a while to have a better place to work, and then if everybody's working better together, you're going to make more money, you're going to make a better return on your efforts regardless of whether you try or not? It's just going to happen. It's just going to happen instinctively. But I don't know if that has to be the first measurement all the time, is whether or not you've made more money than the year before. Maybe the measurement is everyone happy, and is the community you're serving better off, and are you making a fair profit? Maybe that's a better measurement.
And would you encourage CEOs around the world to actually look at it in a more holistic approach as a result of the way you have been phenomenally successful. So people listening to this are going to be trying to get nuggets of, like, you know, would Dave put things into operation at times like post-COVID or during COVID that you couldn't see an automatic return of investment, would you still be doing those things?
Sure. Do those things all the time. Look, if you businesses have, over the last 50 years, have evolved. I know this is not a business podcast, but this is the facts. Businesses have evolved to learn how to extract value as opposed to contribute value to the communities and make a profit. And that's a dangerous shift that they've made. Not all, but most businesses are more focused on extracting value than they are in contributing value to the communities they do business in. And consequently, people instinctively think businesses are bad, and that's bad for business. Because if your customers think you're bad, it's bad for business. So you have to spend all this money on a marketing campaign to get people to trust you. Well, if you did something that made you trustworthy, you wouldn't have to spend all that marketing money, so you'd make more money. So businesses over the last 50 years have made a dangerous shift to be extractors of value instead of contributing to the communities in general. You know, if you take a business that owns 100 stores and a private equity shop buys that business, you know, in the old days, they'd take the bottom performing stores and they'd say, how do we get these stores to perform better? And they'd get the guys and men and women from the top and they'd send them down to the stores in the bottom and they'd say, how do we get this to perform better? Now they just cut off the bottom 10 stores, which makes their metrics better, which makes their average revenue per store better, which makes their average revenue per salesperson better, which makes their average revenue per employee better, which makes their stock price go up, which makes their stock shares goes up, which makes the executives more money. But they forget about the employees and the community at the bottom. And that's why people are pissed off about business. And that's why capitalism has a bad name when it's better than any other form of it's better than it's worked better than communism and socialism, but it has a bad name now because they've overdone the profit thing instead of having a more balanced approach.
Hello, my name is John Sweeney. I'll tell you a story about Scientology. With Scientology, I'm working with two wonderful BBC colleagues, Sarah Moll, my producer, and Bill Brown, Northern Irish cameraman. By the way, Northern Irish, BBC Northern Irish cameraman means tough as old boots, because, you know, they've really, 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 really been in the mill. And if it's a riot, you think, crikey, this is a riot. And I said, no, you should see the Falls Road. okay. And so there is nothing that I can do that's worse than what Bill's been through. Sarah's really funny. She's from Essex. And her plan is simple. We said, "Hey, John, you've seen Jurassic Park, ain't ya?" I said, "Yes, I have." And she said, "Yeah, in it, there's this bit where they tether this goat and then the T-Rex comes and gets it." Well, John, Scientology, they're the T-Rex, and you're the tethered goat. You can bleat, can't you? And that was the plan, and it worked beautifully. And all we had to do was carry two cameras with us at all times, a little camera with batteries, which we could switch on instantly if Bill's big camera wasn't working for some reason. So everywhere we went, we had two cameras as a policy. Everywhere we went, I had two sound packs on me. So if one set of batteries went down, I had the other. It meant going to the loo a fucking nightmare, because I had to, basically, I was like electricity, a small electricity substation. I had so many batteries in me. But it meant that never once were we screwed. We go into battle with the Church of Scientology. And it was the funniest film I've ever made, because they're so fucking nuts and also humorless about themselves. And what was strange was that we were dealing all this time with this guy, Tommy Davis, who I ended up screaming at and shouting at, and I had to apologise. It's wrong to lose your temper, but they drove me nuts. And I can remember saying to Sarah on the seventh day, I said, "Sarah, I can't do this anymore." And she said, "Shut up, get on with your job." Anyway, in the middle of all of this, there's a point when I said to Mike Rinder, the other PR man for Scientology, can we interview your Pope, this guy called David Miscavige, another humorless bastard, in my view. They say that I'm a bigot, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, "No, John." And I said, "Why not?" "Because you're an asshole." And Sarah and I mean, we filmed everything. We've got so much stuff, we don't need to put everything in. And Sarah and Bill just stopped. They put their cameras down and started laughing so much. And then Sarah started saying, "So the reason you won't give us an interview with your Pope is because John's an asshole." And Marina says, "Yes." I said, "I can understand, that's right. Yeah, you are an asshole, John." And she took the piss out of me, and Bill took the piss out of me. And there's a moment when I could see that Mike found this distressing, because we were a good gang, and in a good gang, you can take the piss out of people. Yeah. And eventually, he after that film, he left the Sea Org, and 3 years later, he sat in a chair opposite me, having left the Church of Scientology, and said it was one of the moments was when Sarah and Bill started taking the piss out of me, that he thought he could never do that inside Scientology.
So he actually saw the relevance of being able to put the joke on yourself. How important do you think that is, to be able to laugh at yourself, essentially?
It's crucial for good well-being. Also, it makes life more fun.
Hello, I'm Charlie Hansen. I'm a comedy producer.
Tell me a funny story about something that's happened to you in the business.
Probably the thing that I still, when I think about it, laugh is, and it's not really to do with the business, but I was working. It was when I was doing Cemetery Junction, and it was the last day of filming. We were in Oxfordshire. That was a film I did with Ricky and Stephen, and there was a young cast. It was all about their lives growing up in Reading. We were filming in Oxfordshire, and we were in a hotel, and it wasn't, you know, we were going to have some kind of rap party eventually, but because it was the last day of filming in the country, we all drank in the hotel, and I probably had one or two too many, went to my room, fell asleep, woke up in the middle of the night needing to go to the bathroom, and I ended up opening the door to the bathroom, closing it, and finding I was in the corridor of the hotel, completely naked. And I was mortified. It wasn't funny at the time, I can tell you. I was absolutely horrified. And I got in the lift, went to the ground floor, went to the loo, you know, the main loos on the ground floor near the bar, dashing without making sure. I could hear people at near reception, so I knew there were people around. Went into the loo, and all I could do was get paper towels. And I put one in front of me and one behind me and came out, and then literally had to make a dash to the receptionist, holding one paper towel behind, one at the back, and say, "I've locked myself out of my room." And I mean, they just looked at me. They didn't need an explanation. They just gave me a pass key, and I kind of ran back. And apart from the receptionist and someone else, I think only two people saw me and thought, "What the hell's going on there?" It's about 12 years ago, but I still, every now and again, you know, when I'm in a new hotel, I'm reminded. So now I kind of, if I'm in a, I like, you know, to get to sleep, I like it dark. So I tend to now put the light on in the bathroom and leave the door with a tiny crack so I know where the bathroom is.
Hello, hello, hello. I'm Dilly Keane. I mean, the funniest thing that's ever happened was one of those moments you can't really explain it. It was, I was on stage and I had put on a tiny bit of weight and my rather skin tight dress sort of went and split down the side. And it was fascinating, Ada, and Marilyn Cutts was in the group then, and she came over to the piano. Luckily it had split upstage as opposed to downstage, which meant the audience would see. I was seated at the piano. It was my left seam. And I said to Marilyn, I went, "Marilyn, my dress was split." And she went, "Yes." Said, "My dress was split." She went, "Yes." And walked off stage. So I had to get up. And luckily, I had a jacket.
Hello, I'm Gareth Southgate. And I just wanted to say that please listen to Alistair McGowan on Paul Barossi's Humorology podcast.
One of the callbacks I started doing I was going to say recently, it was back in whenever we could still do live gigs, so at least 6 months ago. But I was doing this callback more or less for the first time, and I loved it. I had this idea, which I wanted to put in for a long time, about what people sound like they're going to say next and how useful that is for an impression. So what you're going to say next, but don't say, if you like, reveals a lot about your character. And for me, impressions are about the human voice, and the voice is about your character. It reveals something through your voice. So for instance, the first one was that Cheryl Cole, or whatever she's going by nowadays, I think she's just Cheryl now, but Cheryl always sounds like the next thing she would say after any given sentence would be, "And that's why I had to kill him." She just has this sort of very, very dark attitude to life and to people. And so that was lovely when I say, "And that's why I had to kill him." And then I do two or three more jokes, because I tried it once, one after the other, and it didn't work. And then I say, Richard Madeley always sounds like the next thing he'd say in any given sentence would be, "I'm not rubbish, and this program isn't shit." And again, it's his attitude. There's a sort of defensiveness there. No. This is worth listening to. I'm not rubbish, and this program isn't shit. So you don't hear him say that, but it sounds like what's defining him. But by separating them with a joke in between each one and then going back to it, I won't give you the third one because it'll, decrease the laugh if ever I do it again in front of anyone who might be watching or listening. But actually, the third one was Steve Bruce, who was Newcastle manager, still is at the moment. And he always sounds like the next thing he's going to say is, "Well, I can't believe they've given us the job, to be honest with you." But by separating those out, the callback, the slight variation each time, really, really helped. And again, that's not telling jokes. That's not me saying, "Oh, here's a funny thing for you. You know, here's a funny joke for you." It's an observation. It's a bit of wit. It's hard to recreate that. I mean, if every business person could do all that sort of stuff, they'd be doing stand-up comedy. But they are useful techniques.
Well, I'm John LaValle.
So, I mean, a lot of our audience, and you work with, you know, big businesses all over the world, and you advise them, and a lot of our audience are going to think, what can I take away from this? And I know you're a great man for giving takeaways and things. And how can anybody be slightly, not necessarily funnier, but slightly, you know, better at getting rapport, better at connecting by using humor?
Someone asked me one time, they said, "To what do you contribute most of your success, both in business, getting deals you've gotten, contracts you've gotten, and in seminars? And you seem to take a lot of maybe unnecessary risks in doing things, but I also know you're somewhat successful." I said, "Well, I've learned very simply that I don't care. I don't care. And I'm prepared to walk away and leave the deal on the table." So now what that does is that gives people enough confidence that they're gonna probably come back and get the deal. You know, if you've done a good job, rapport is easy enough. I'm not talking about the body matching things, you know. The rapport stuff is easy enough. People don't go in, if they go in with their PowerPoint and they're all ready to show their slides and everything, they should stop and go do something else, you know. If they can't feed off the group and everything else. When I've gone in business meetings, I'm going to go in with a group of executives, and I always make fun of them, by the way. I always make fun of the guys at top. I always want to get in with, and some of them object to this, but I don't care. I said, "I don't care," right? I want to talk to their boss, because that's ultimately where my contract comes from. Yeah. Because if the guy hiring me, right, if he doesn't like what I'm doing, he can say, "You're out." But I can say, "Excuse me, this is what your boss wants. You didn't get the message. So I'm actually helping you out," you know? But I've had that attitude where there's loads of business out there, you know, and I can choose who I want to work for, not work for, or work with, and everything else. And I think for people who have that confidence, I guess one might be part of that, they're free to feel and be funny.
Hello, this is William Hague. Margaret Thatcher was not funny. You know, that was not her
approach. She was, in my view, an extremely impressive, brilliant person in so many ways. And everybody would, whatever their political views, would say she was a very major figure in history and an important leader. But she wasn't funny. She didn't react that very well to humor because she didn't really get it. And she would enjoy having an argument, she would enjoy having a discussion. But whereas many people, as we've just been discussing, would inject some humor into it to help it along, that just wasn't her approach at all. So, you know, you can be successful without humor, but it does create a pretty serious atmosphere around you, and you'd better have some other massive attributes if you're going to do without it.
But they did actually bring in writers for her when she did the big set pieces at the Conservative Party conference, and she somehow did manage to get laughs as well, didn't she, in set pieces?
She did, but she didn't really, you know, she delivered the lines and they explained, but there was one, I can't quite remember the detail, but it was a Monty Python allusion in one of her speeches. And, you know, then apparently she said, well, we must get this Monty Python into, you know, give us some more ideas. So she hadn't really understood what it was all about. So yes, she could be persuaded to use some humor, but she just wasn't a naturally humorous person. And maybe so you can't have everything. She would have been an even more impressive, but she would have got her way even more often, probably, if she'd also been able to carry people along with a bit of humour.
I just got this image of her going, get me that Monty Python on the phone.
Hello, this is Mark Bedford from Manus.
That's very interesting, actually, that whole thing about the shared experience, because when I'm working with people, I'm advising, you know, CEOs or whatever, I say it's much more important to listen, because all good connection and humour from connection comes out of listening. And it's the understanding that really it's hard to do a gag. You can't go into a meeting and go, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to do this gag when I walk in the room.
Yeah. Never
really works, does it? You have to feel what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to feel your way in. And one interesting thing that you're touching on there about laughter and about humour is it really does balance up power. And I think if you're in a position of power, I think it's a very good skill to have, is to listen and allow people who, you know, that maybe that either work for you or you're kind of maybe in more, say, a senior position of, but it's to listen and let them laugh and let them make jokes, because it really does balance things up. And people, again, feel that there's a kinship more between one another. I think it's quite an important point there.
I like the word kinship. I think that's really the thing, because I think that's what humour does, is it drags people together and go, oh, from a psychological aspect, we like people like us. And automatically, if you share a sense of humour, you are automatically in the tribe, aren't you?
Yeah. And it signals, as I said, it signals a cooperation. You know, it signals that you're in agreement, you know, which is like very, very important, yeah, amongst groups of people. I think that's what we do. And as I say, it's almost a survival tactic, I think, in a way, you know. If you're kind of brought into that group and you're joined together by humour, it starts to create a fantastic bond, I think, you know.
I'm Georgie Holt.
What I loved when you said earlier is that you laugh easily. And you
do
love to laugh.
Yeah.
But by the way, that is a very attractive trait to anybody listening out there. That is as important. I have a great friend who is witty, but is not as quick as the rest of us when we're doing gags. But we love him because he laughs so easily, and he's a joy to be around.
I think if you can find someone who you want to laugh with, that is really important. And I have a few friends that I will always love to laugh with, and I look forward to seeing them because I know I'm going to laugh, and that I look forward to that feeling and feel renewed and energized after it happens. Sometimes exhausted as well, because obviously laughter can be tiring sometimes too. But yeah.
But isn't that wonderful? You see, I'm looking at your face. And you see, this is what happens. You just have to think about those people. And a smile plays across your face. Yeah, and it changes your whole mood. And that's, you know, I think, you know, that's what business should do as well. We all spend so much time at work. But if you can bring some laughter into a workplace scenario, you're doing everybody a favour.
Yeah, because it's so good for you. You know, laughter, as we know, is, you talked about it being the best medicine, but, you know, there's, I mean, you'll know this better than anyone, but the science to show how good laughing is for you, it releases endorphins, it releases chemicals in the body that help relax you. It releases chemicals that are similar to the love chemical, you know, oxytocin, like all of those chemicals are released. So actually, being quick to laugh and finding people that help you do that is going to make you feel better and feel good, whether it's conscious or I've done it consciously or unconsciously. I think I've sought out that good feeling when I've certainly, particularly in more difficult times. But it really is so good for you.
Well, we should bottle it and sell it.
We should. I mean, it's surprising that no one's been able to do that yet. I mean, they kind of have, but it's not legal.
Hi, I'm James Longman, the co-executive producer of The Late Late Show with James Corden.
Well, talking of that, what would the world be like without humour?
Well, I think a sadder, greyer place. I was thinking about this, actually, we had a really lovely thing. Well, a couple of times really where people have said to me, what I do often, I think, is I make a lot of nonsense. A lot of the stuff I've made on all the shows over the years have a thread of silliness through them and nonsense. And sometimes I throw away humor and go, oh, it's not a proper job. I'm very lucky to do it. But every now and again, you'll meet someone and they'll go, oh, we're going through a really dark time and we saw that sketch you did and it really lifted us out of it. And the idea that, you know, humour can help people, which is when you do it day to day, you forget about that. And it's really lovely when someone says something really lovely to you about it. You know, you need humour to kind of to lift you and move you along and to help you, and it can heal. So I think a world without humour would be a much sadder place.
Well, as a psychologist, I can tell you that it's a state shifter. And so actually what you are doing is, so when your children get a little bit older and they ask you what you do, what will you reply?
I have the classic Brit about me, where I'm always a little bit embarrassed about being proud of what I do. Which is a very un-American thing, I think. But it's I guess I'd say when they're a little bit older, I say I make silly TV. I make TV that makes people laugh, which is what I think my career has been, really, making TV that makes people laugh.
But that's a lovely thing, isn't it? My son is now 19, so he's grown up. And for the last few years, when his friends have asked, what does your dad do? My son says he talks bollocks for a living. Harsh, but true, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But you know what? You're at the wonderful age where daddy's a hero, and you just wait, my friend.
I've got one of these, but really, it should go to Paul and the Humorology Podcast.
The Humorology Podcast was hosted by Paul Barros and produced by Simon Banks. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.